This is the Android Buffet Podcast, episode number 559, recorded Thursday, October 7th, 2021. In 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1.
Dum-dum-dum.
Welcome to another exciting episode of the Android Buffet Podcast.
Woohoo!
So how are you this week, Jerry?
I'm really frustrated right now.
Why are you frustrated?
Because my mouse keeps hesitating.
Do you have one of those mouse jigglers that I hear so much about?
One of those who?
Those things that jiggle mice.
No.
You've heard of those, though.
No.
They're mouse jigglers. They keep your mouse jiggling so that your screen doesn't lock.
Oh, nope.
It seems like an interesting choice of device, but
that's one way to achieve an effect.
I'm sure there's a purpose to it. But so other than your mouse jiggling, is everything going all right?
Yes. I started my full-on in-depth journey into Home Assistant since we've last talked.
Well, I know, because I got this weird support message from you.
It can be weird.
Well, no, weird because I don't often hear from you very much in the middle of the week, and I heard from you. So just hearing from you for a longer conversation outside of the show is somewhat rare.
Well,
not that I minded it.
You're the expert, man. I'm new at this.
Yeah. So, from what I recall, you were having some problems with a Z-Wave switch.
Yeah.
How'd that work out?
I eventually let it just... Okay, so Wednesday, a new version of Home Assistant came out. Seeing as it's the first Wednesday of the month. And one of the things that this version released was that the Z-Wave JS integration now supports S2, which basically means secured connections to your Z-Wave devices.
Well, no, better secured connections, because it did support S0 before.
Okay. Well, apparently, so I tried to get my Z-Wave devices to be secured and was having none of it. Sometimes it would kind of work on the first switch. I never got it to work on any of the other switches.
Well, I abandoned Z-Wave for switches a while ago. I still have some Z-Wave stuff, but I had problems with Z-Wave. I had problems with Zigbee. I rarely had problems with Wi-Fi, but again, there's only so many Wi-Fi devices you can have around. So I have a mix. And the one Z-Wave switch I had installed just died, and I did not replace it. So I still have some other Z-Wave stuff, but nothing wired in at the moment.
Well, I originally got some cheap Z-Wave switches, and I got super frustrated with it because I could not adjust how long between me pressing the button and a reaction. And it was like a second between pushing the button and a reaction. And another 3 seconds until the lights came on fully because they ramped up. It's a dimmer switch. So I got some Enovelis, and the Enovelis let you adjust every parameter. And I'm quite happy with them.
Those are the ones with the customizable LEDs that you can flash.
Yeah, I haven't done anything with the LEDs yet.
Well, future expansion is always a good thing.
But they're nice switches. They were easy to install. I mean, they were pretty much a unscrew the old one and screw in the new one.
Well, your house was built in what year?
2018.
Yeah, so that makes sense.
Right. I have neutral wires.
No, I have neutral wires. It's just, I think you've heard me sort of mention this before. The building that I live in the apartment, one was wired in a, let's just say, way that indicates that the builder did not hire the most competent electricians. And two, all the boxes, you know, because then they didn't have to worry about some of the stuff we have now, the boxes are all shallow. So it's a struggle sometimes to actually fit a deep smart switch into one of these boxes.
Yeah, I don't really have that problem.
Yeah, no, I know. But that's why I'm saying it is a cinch when you have the room to do it. But when you're trying to struggle with this and then, you know, you push too hard, you put the thing in and then it shorts out. Or then you discover that there are just too many wires in there. And then you have to consider, do I really want to find somebody to rip the box out of the wall? Because there are things I'm willing to do. Replace a light switch or an outlet, fine. Replace the entire box on the wall, I really don't want to do. I've done it once or twice, but I am not an artist in that regard. And I want it to look like it's supposed to be there.
Yep.
I told you the story of the wall that I had put in here for sound retention during podcasts.
Yes. And
the one instruction I gave to the guy who built the wall for me was, I want this wall to look like it was here before today.
So he put it in crooked?
No, as in, like, it fits in. It doesn't look like it was added. It looks like it's always been there.
In some of the houses that I've got, that would mean putting that wall in crooked.
Well, he did other things. He's the guy who just fixed the leak in my bathroom as well. Well, technically the guy, he's a contractor, so his people. And I have some issues there that I be asking him to come back for have a discussion about. But, well, no, that's par for the course with anybody who you hire to do anything. They have their vision of how it should be done. You have your vision and you're the customer, and they say the customer is always right, but that doesn't work well in reality.
Okay. Other integrations that I've got working. So the Innovelli lights, they actually give consumption in the when they're on it. Well, I guess they give consumption when they're off too. They're just the consumption is zero. I finished reflashing those GoSun WP3 switches or plugs.
Yeah, what are you using them to power?
Right now, I have four of them. Two of them are turning on salt lamps on and off. So I have a salt lamp in my office and a salt lamp in our bedroom.
What's a salt lamp again?
It's a lamp that's made, looks like it's made out of a big old chunk of salt. It is made out of a big old chunk of salt.
Oh, I've never seen one of these. I'll have to look into it.
Apparently they're good for ionizing the air, and I don't know. My wife says turn it on every now and then. I turn it on every now and then. Now I don't have to remember. Now you may recall that I had some GoSun smart outlets.
Yeah.
That I was using the GoSun app for. So flashing those was not really an option.
Unless you can find the chip.
Right, and I didn't want to bust these things open. I didn't even want to get them out of the wall again.
Yeah, and you know my continual saga of 3D printed flashing jig, holding wires on with my bare hands. You've heard me talk about that.
Yep, didn't want to go through that.
Well, I don't do that after I've put it in the wall. If I can't get it working before it goes in the wall, it's not going in the wall.
Well, I ended up installing the Tuya app, resetting the switches, and then adding them to the Tuya app. And then I signed up for a developer account at Tuya Smart. And doing that let me integrate those switches using the Tuya V2 integration. Although that wasn't my first stop. My first stop was one of the things that got released yesterday, also was a native Tuya integration.
Yeah, I saw that, but since I don't want to deal with third-party servers because it creates latency, I've never tried it.
Well, the native Tuya integration did not give me power consumption on those plugs. So I thought I did something wrong. So I tried the V2 version. And the V2 version does give me consumption. And it's sometimes there's a delay. My next step will be the Tuya local integration.
Yeah, which should help a bit with the latency. I've just, again, being a purist, I've actually decided to get rid of the one cloud integration that I had to compromise on recently.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned that I'm back in my apartment, which for the last, let's just call say, the pandemic period, I've been sort of sporadically in, as you've heard me sort of, I'm not going to say complain about, but comment on the fact that I miss being at home.
Yeah.
So the one thing that I had hooked up otherwise were these USB smart switches that Sonoff made. And what they did was they allowed me to turn off cameras. So I have several Wyze cams inside, but I don't want cameras inside to be powered on when I'm in here. But I don't trust Wyze, even though they have a disabled thing, to handle that. So I'm essentially handling it by cutting the power to them. So I'm using these smart USB switches, but they're somewhat unreliable. And again, I don't really like things that rely on third-party servers. And the Sonoff stuff is powered by the U-Link servers, even though they have a US-based server. That's a Chinese company. Not that I distrust Chinese companies inherently, but I don't trust them in the long term. Namely, when you pay $4 for a device, you cannot trust that they're going to keep their server up indefinitely.
That's true.
So what I did was I went to another Chinese company. You're familiar with companies like AliExpress, Banggood, and all that?
Yes.
So I ordered 10 of these essentially USB smart switches that are powered by the ESP8266 chip, which means they can be flashed with Tasmota. They're sitting on my desk waiting. So I need. I've already opened up the first one with a spudger. I find that word very funny. And there are four little contacts here that if I can get something into them, and I think I have something small enough, that I can flash this with Tasmota without having to solder anything on, which is what I prefer, and then get all of them in. They were about $3 a pop. I ordered enough to reconvert everything. So one of the projects I'm going to have to do while I'm here is flash them all. Also, I finally figured out how to get those dimmer switches open. I've been opening plastic devices that are not supposed to be opened all week. Also metal devices. Well, I got some new tools.
Well, apparently, once you get the Tuya app, the Tuya V2 going, so that you can get the device private keys, you can use Tuya local, and you don't, and nothing ever goes out to the Tuya cloud servers again.
I know. I like 100% control. I've had to compromise a few times, and I might have to again in the future. But if I pick my devices carefully, I don't think I have to compromise.
So I don't know if you remember this, but when I first moved here, one of the things that I wanted to integrate was my pool system, the AquaLink system. And there wasn't an integration for it. There is now, and it works well. And I also, there was no integration for my Carrier air conditioning system, which was cloud-based, but they're really not Home Assistant friendly. So apparently there's this thing called Infinitude. It's a Docker image that you spin the Docker image up.
Yeah.
And then you point you go to the air conditioning control unit.
Yeah.
And you tell it to use that Docker image as a proxy. And it will, forward things, but it also keeps up and it can also forge signals or forge responses. And I can use that, and I use that to integrate my carrier system into Home Assistant. And that seems to be working well.
Yeah, that's a common way of getting around these systems where they essentially intercept communications. And then if you still want the other system to get it, they'll just...
What else? My Roborock vacuums are hooked up. They seem to work well. My sprinkler system is integrated.
So what automations have you put in? Because again, linking everything so you can do automations is fun. You know, that's a hobbyist thing, but it's the automations that make it, it all worth it.
So far, the only thing I've done is I turn the salt lamps on at sundown and turn them off at midnight. And Home Assistant has now taken over management of when my pool pumps and lights and waterfalls turn on.
You have a waterfall?
That's scheduled. Yeah.
Okay. Fancy. I don't have a waterfall.
It's part of the pool.
No, I know. I'm just saying that's very fancy. I also don't.
And I did that in Node Red, and I had some issues with it. Thinking, so I told it to turn on at dusk or sundown, sunset.
Yeah.
And it was turning on around noon.
How did it know what sunset was?
Well, Home Assistant knows where I am.
Yeah, what I'm saying is
knows what the time zone is.
You're feeding that information from Home Assistant.
Well, the problem turned out to be that I needed to set the time zone in Node Red. So there's a config option for set or a.
So I was right. I was right. The problem was that was exactly what I was trying to ask, which is, was the time zone offset right?
The time zone offset, there is a place, but if you don't set it, then it gets the time zone from Home Assistant, which was right. The problem was that I was using a thing in Node Red called Big Timer.
I've heard of it, but I'm not a Node Red user, so I've only read things about Node Red.
And inside that setup, when you set up an individual Big Timer, there's a latitude and longitude, and they were set to 0.
No, that would explain why the time was off.
Right?
Yeah.
So when I set the latitude and longitude to accurate, then the timers started acting right.
Yeah. If you didn't want to use a Home Assistant for those switches that turn your salt lamp on, Tasmota, which you flashed on, it actually can do that on board if you give it the latitude and longitude.
Yes.
I do that for dawn dust timers. I have it run directly on the device, and then I have Home Assistant handle the atypical stuff. The idea being that if everything goes down, the on-off for dawn dusk will just keep running.
I still don't know what I want to do. So right now I'm still getting things connected.
Well, I do have a question for you from Daryl.
Yes.
He wants to know, are you happy with carrier? Because Daryl changed to Rudd. And everything works consistently about 7 years ago.
He changed to what?
RUUD. I assume that's Rudd. Admittedly, I assume it's an alternative HVAC system, but HVAC systems are not my area of expertise.
I mean, the temperature in the house is comfortable. And I'm not about to pay to replace the HVAC system. Because that's going to be a $20,000-$25,000 proposition, and I'd rather not.
Yeah, and for me, I don't know much about HVAC systems because I've never had one. As you've heard me mention, I have no central air conditioning here.
Weird.
I have sleeve air conditioning, which is very common in this type of building, and then I do have central heat, but that's done through hydronics. And that's fairly common. Now, I was hanging around in my family's house upstate, as you know, and there they have central air, which was built in a weird, atypical way, which I've been trying to get somebody to fix that for years. And the heat is actually line voltage. which makes home automation of line voltage heating really hard. There are not really? Well, the problem is each room has its own thermostat hooked into a line voltage electric baseboard. And there are a few problems. One, electric baseboards tend to dry out the air even more than other heating things, which means some problems. But the biggest thing is there aren't that many line voltage smart thermostats. And even if you want to, every room has its own thermostat, which means you'd need one smart thermostat per room, and that can get a bit pricey.
Hmm.
So what I did there is the central air only has one zone that covers the whole building. That has a Z-Wave thermostat that is remotely controlled by Home Assistant. So otherwise, it's set by the unit itself where you just set the temperature. And any programs are just slave to Home Assistant. And then there's one thermostat, the one in the living room, that's remotely connected. Because that would mean that if it was cold and someone was coming up there and wanted the house to be warm when they got there, the main room would be warm and the other rooms would be manually turned on. Otherwise, again, it would be hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And then in my parents' apartment in Florida, I put in, they do have central air conditioning. I put in a Wyze thermostat to experiment with it. But it's been offline for months because their apartment is a disaster. But that's a whole other story, which I think I've mentioned a little. But here, because even though I haven't been here and everything was working when I left, when I came back, several things were broken. So I have a retrofit downlight, which is I put a Zigbee Sylvania downlight into one of the old recessed lights in the ceiling here that I had put in probably 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And there are two of them in the room near the window. And one of them is working. And the other one, every time I turn it off, it turns itself on an hour later. And I've been trying to figure out why for 2 days now. And I can't. So I've decided I got the Sylvania down lights when Lowe's was clearing them out. And maybe I shouldn't continue to maintain a product that the entire product line has been discontinued by the manufacturer. So I decided to swap them out for... I have never bought a Philips Hue product before, so I decided to try. They're supposed to be top-of-the-line Zigbee devices. So I decided, since I only have two downlights in my apartment, I decided to swap them out for Philips. So that's a little more expensive than what I originally paid, but I bought everything on clearance. So hopefully that'll solve the problem, and if it doesn't, then I'm not spending any more money to solve it. I'll just go with a dumb light and then see about wiring in a smart switch. The reason I'm using the individuals is I often turn, since there's a left and a right and there's my television, I often have the one over my television turn off when I'm watching something that's dark, and I don't want to turn off the one in the back. And then, of course, as I said, I'm dismantling dozens of little switches to reflash and redo. I have the dimmer switch in my kitchen will not dim. Well, actually, it will dim. It will not dim at the switch. I can only dim it by controlling it in Home Assistant. So there's something wrong with the button configuration.
So, goodness.
Oh, no, a lot of little things. The generic thermostat that I'm using to run my air conditioner in this room isn't working because I upgraded the temperature sensor and it doesn't know the name of the current sensor, so it's not controlling it. So I have to go look up the name of that sensor, but I wanted to upgrade that sensor further, so I have to find where I have it in this room and move it to a different location. So a lot of, again, little tweaks that I have to do, and I'm hoping to be here long enough to actually do them. So I'm going to be here for the next few weeks at minimum. Then if my parents' apartment in Florida is no longer a disaster area, I promised them I would come and help them clean it up.
What are you using for, like, presence detection?
A variety of things. So first of all, I have door sensors. So all the exterior doors are wired up. So now, in addition to that tracking, I have, of course, every phone that routinely comes into the building is transmitting its presence to Home Assistant directly. So essentially, I've made sure that my phone is transmitting it, among others. So in addition to that, I have a device scanning for Bluetooth. And of course, I'm hooked into, since I have a Unify wireless access point system, I can actually get devices that connect to the Wi-Fi.
And are you using that presence detection for any automations?
Yes and no. That's what turns on and off the cameras. That's the only real one that I'm doing right now. I did have this sort of experiment where I wanted to, when I walked in the door, there's a Google Smart Display in my kitchen, which is where the entrance to my apartment is.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to say, you know, like, welcome home. But I could never quite get the timing right, and I didn't feel like going outside and coming back in to test it. So the problem is, because it detects my presence, like, further from my actual door than I am, I need to, when it detects that I'm home, wait until, set a trigger that will wait until I actually open the door to my apartment so I can actually hear the welcome home message. So it's not that I couldn't do that, it's just I never really invested enough time to get it working.
Or just make it say welcome home louder so you can hear it from outside.
That would be, where I park my car and the door, just so that wouldn't necessarily work. But I have a few other tweaks I need to do, and then I have some automations to fix. I'm getting notification fatigue. I configured more sensors to alert me when there something happens, but I think I set the settings a bit too low. So I'm getting notifications when a variety of things happen. And Daryl does have another thought on this, that we're getting too complicated. Do we really need this? Because he's currently looking for a 1970s car for the floaty ride and cheap to repair. And convenience is tiring. But it's a hobby. So I'm...
I don't know, because the vehicle that I bought, yeah. I bought a really high-tech truck. Which, interestingly, there is an integration for my truck. I haven't installed it yet, but... There is a home assistant integration for...
Well, sometimes the integration is just because it's fun integrating things. But a lot of the times, that's why I sort of asked, well, what are you going to automate with it? And a lot of the stuff I did, I automated sensors. And I have a few other things I've done. For example, I mentioned the thing with my light and the TV. And I actually had that automated for a while. The problem was that on some shows, there's no way I could figure out for it to know whether or not I was watching a dark show or not. So I had that problem, but I had it at one point that it would dim the light above the TV, there wouldn't be glare. But the reason I stopped doing it automatically is I moved where the television was. So the problem wasn't the glare, the problem is now just dark shows.
I don't know. My wife's been out of town. So yeah. We're going to see what she wants to do. I suspect that for right now, it's mainly just going to be having lights coming on and turning off at specific times of the day so we don't have to remember.
Well, I have a lot of...
Which is kind of boring.
I do. Remember, I'm running 3 instances of Home Assistant in 3 different locations. So each of them is monitoring that house, so it actually does form the backbone of my security system. So you could say, in terms of simplicity... while I'm doing some of these fun things, what I really want to know is if somebody who is not supposed to be there shows up. For example, in the Home Assistant in upstate New York, which is running right now, it's turned on all of the security measures because there's nobody there. And my parents, who, again, take care of things up there because after my grandparents passed away, they're the primary owners. They arranged for somebody to go in and clean. So I started getting security alerts. So I was getting alerts frequently, including when they apparently must have been cleaning the bathroom because they set off the water leak sensor. So knowing whether or not there's a water leak in a remote building that you're not at, knowing whether or not somebody who's not supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Those are things that are useful, and I like using Home. So that's my thing in regards to their apartment in Florida. Same thing. They're up here right now. They're going back in a few days to try to see if they can figure out how to get the person who destroyed their apartment to finish with it.
To finish destroying it?
No, to actually fix it.
Well, destruction is much easier than...
Well, here's the thing. He destroyed it in the spring very quickly, and he was supposed to be done in July, and he's not doing that much. It is now October, and he keeps saying, no, it won't be done, or that it'll be done this week, then it'll be next week. And they've been up here, and they're of the opinion if they went and, you know, sort of were there, he might be more likely to show up. So they cannot actually be in their apartment. So they are going to stay elsewhere for a few days and actually try to deal with this. But I was going to go with them if the apartment was ready and help them put all their stuff away, except, again, there's nowhere for me. So I'm staying here, which is nice because I have plenty to do here. Anyway, me and my family stuff aside, I like having all of this automation.
Yeah, I'm just still not sure what I'm going to do with it yet. I mean, like I say, right now I've got it automating my pool.
Sometimes the journey is more fun than the reality.
Jerry has joined the channel.
What was that?
That was evidence that my speakers are way too loud.
Yeah. I'm glad Jerry joined the channel. Anyway. We have a few things to talk about in regards to some news.
News. I like news.
So, first of all, Android 12 is now live in AOSP.
Does that mean we're going to get it sometime soon?
Well, this is sort of different because usually when the code drops, it's very close to launching. But I think because of the way that they're doing it this time, I think there'll be more of a gap. Probably within the next few weeks is my guess.
Still, that's pretty cool. And I'm hoping that having Google devices means we'll get it relatively quickly.
Yeah, and the simple truth is the real thing that I want fixed is that whole problem I have with battery that I was telling you about. That it seems to, even when it's in airplane mode, it just seems to be draining. And I'm not sure why. I assume it's a malfunctioning app.
I blame the Home Assistant Companion.
All I'm going to say is that Google, in the last few versions, has made it increasingly harder to find out which app is misbehaving.
True enough.
So I don't know. I'd get rid of whatever app it was and find an alternative or disable it. But now the only way to do it is to essentially disable things and try to figure out which one it is. Except before I used to be able to, you know, do things like wake lock detection and all this stuff to figure it out. Now you can't really effectively do that. Which is a shame.
Yeah.
If you don't like your Pixel 5 anymore, you can get yourself a Pixel 6. It's going to launch on October 19th.
I don't think I want a 6.
I haven't paid for the 5 yet. Admittedly,
I think the 5's really, really attractive, but the 6 with that band across the back is just... I don't know, man.
To be honest, I didn't get the... When I got the 5, I was still paying off the last few bits of the 3. But I think I'm sort of a like every other edition person.
Right.
So probably if I got the 5, the next one I might consider is the 7. Unless something breaks again, which spurred me because if my 3 was still working, I might have waited for the 6. Sort of hard to tell. So moving along, there was a nice opinion piece suggesting that Google cares more about the iPad than Android in terms of tablets.
Well, sure.
Well, they haven't done a good tablet. The last good Nobody's tablet, well, the last sort of good tablet they did was the Nexus 7. But they haven't really, you know, the same way that they've sort of not done much with Wear OS and now they're promising they're going to. The tablet market, they could invest more in it and try to get a foothold, but maybe they've decided that they can't and that they're never going to beat the iPad in that regard.
The iPad's a hell of a tablet, man. It really is. It's hard to beat.
That doesn't mean it's unbeatable. A few years ago, before Android, people would have said the iPhone was impossible to beat.
Today, some people might still say that.
Yeah, but you understand my point. If you're saying just because there's a company that's very popular, that you can't have a competing product, especially if you're Google, a company that has enough resources to try to do that. But again, maybe they don't want to. Maybe they've decided it's not worth it. You've heard the expression, if you can't beat them, join them?
Yes.
Isn't that my point? Maybe they couldn't beat them, so they decided to join them, or that it wasn't worth beating them.
I think that's what it comes down to. It's not worth it.
So let's see what else. Omega Launcher came out, which is a fork of Launcher Launcher, which you've heard me mention, which is a open source. It's not a open source version of the Pixel Launcher. It is an open source launcher that is designed to have some of the Pixel-like features. So it is a open source launcher inspired by the Pixel Launcher. And now there's a new launcher, Omega Launcher, which is a fork of that and does a bunch of other things.
Okay.
And this next feature is something I've wanted for a while. Google Photos has added the ability to edit the date and time of uploaded photos and videos on the Android app.
Wow.
Well,
cool.
The reason that I actually want this is back in 2013 and 2014, I scanned hundreds of pictures using a third-party service. So all the pictures, the date that's being used, because unlike a cell phone photo, it isn't automatically stamped with when it was taken, was the date it was scanned.
Right.
So I have all these photos that say they were taken in 2014 that were actually taken in the period between, let's say, 1900 and 2000. Well, actually, probably more like 99, give or take, is probably when I started doing my first digital.
But how are you going to put dates on them?
Well, there. I'll give you a few examples. First of all, I can probably narrow down the year. I might not be able to get the exact day and time, but I should be able to narrow down to the year. Number two, some things are pictures of events, and I know what day it was. For example, I'll give you one. I have pictures of my father's graduation. I know what date that was. I have it written down.
Ah. Another thought appears. If you have the actual photo itself, oftentimes on the back it is...
Yeah,
The developer will stamp the back with the date it was developed.
Yeah, which I could use. It's probably close enough because usually you would have the photos developed of completing the role.
A few weeks tops. Yeah,
so I can get the month. If I can get the month and the year, that would be helpful because, as you know, since I've mentioned it many times, I have all Google Smart Displays primarily to use as digital photo frames. And now that they show the date the photo was taken, it really annoys me that they're all showing 2014 for these black and white photos from the past.
Well, at least now you can change it. That's cool. Yeah,
but the idea is if I change it, I can find the photo and sort of do it then. Otherwise, I could just sit at my computer and try to change it. Or for the ones that were taken prior to my birth, you know, sit down my parents and ask them to identify what year they think the photo was taken, which I've done a few times. My mother's really good at that. I have a horrible memory for dates, but she has a wonderful one. So, and I'd sort of like to do that just, you know, for the historical completeness of it. I spent all these time scanning these things. I sort of like to put them in some sort of context.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But we'll see. So that's one of those things where, again, it's a simple thing, being able to edit it. And I don't know if anybody at Google, you know, is thinking of my use case. Possibly because they put it in. But I'm not sure because, again, Google Photos seems more focused on post-digital photography than pre-digital photography. But you never know. So moving along, if you are a user of Firefox, they are adding to their Android app password autofill support. So they want to be a password manager for the entire phone, not just the browser.
Really?
Well, Google's doing
this. And I'm still having trouble getting LastPass to integrate with Firefox Mobile.
That may be intentional on one side or the other. Not specifically LastPass, but I think Firefox's focus on privacy does sort of make it hard for autofill within it. I think it's doable, though. But I think there are a bunch of other things going on. But both Firefox and if you look down on the list here, Google's adding a shortcut to their password manager. Both of them are taking their Chrome and Firefox browser password managers and making them system-wide password managers. So
I'm glad. The problem is that's going to make it harder for startups.
Well, isn't that always like, the way when the OS integrates something that used to be independent?
Yeah, but I don't trust the operating system. It's especially for something like passwords.
Well, there are things other than LastPass that are relatively popular. There are, 1Password, there's Bitwarden. A lot of people were really unhappy with LastPass during their when they changed their pricing model.
Right.
So there are alternatives. And again, alternatives don't necessarily mean that one particular product is bad. It just means there may be something that better is suited for you.
And right, but if there's a default, something that is automatically available,
people will use it. The same way that's how Internet Explorer, despite being a less than stellar product, in my opinion, got so much market share.
Quick anecdote, real semi-related. I found a website that doesn't work on Chrome, doesn't work on Firefox, only works in Microsoft Edge.
That's strange. There are some like classic sites that only worked in Explorer, but only working in Edge.
It's Vanguard. Vanguard's site only works in Edge.
That's weird.
Isn't it though?
Yeah.
It boggles my mind. Yeah.
And Daryl is commenting that he bought a Samsung. He bought the 21 instead of the Pixel. Because he felt it was more cutting edge, but he can't figure out how to turn off the Samsung password manager so that he can get back to the Google password manager.
Sounds evil to me.
Well, again, that's we've gone from the OS manufacturer to the hardware manufacturer trying to do your passwords. And, every so often, and I, out in addition to LastPass, I actually do keep KeePass, which is self-hosted. So KeePass has an Android app. It has a browser thing that you can self-host. It has there's a Nextcloud plugin. There is an app for pretty much every operating system, and it stores the passwords in a heavily encrypted file. So I do keep that for various things.
There's heavily encrypted, you say?
Proportional to how much you wish to encrypt it. It has different encryption options, but it's the same idea. It's encrypted based on a master password. So that is what I use for some things, because in the event that I lose access to LastPass, I need someplace to have critical information. I don't care if I have to go reset my password for non-critical sites, but there are a few that I just keep in a file, encrypted, stored somewhere.
Along those lines, yep. I've been given some thought to how massively screwed I would be if Google ever considers me persona non grata.
Didn't I say that about, not screwed, but didn't I say that was why I was afraid of ticking off the people at Amazon? When I was talking about my fights with them, that they could really negatively impact me financially if they decided to cut me off. Google's pretty much the same way.
If I lose my email address, I lose access to damn near everything.
Well, see, this is the difference between me and you. While Google is hosting my mail, the address is at my domain. So if they did cut me off, I might lose a little, but I would be able to point the mail server somewhere else within however long it takes to propagate.
I've been using my email address for the past 20 years. Yeah, about.
And it's a Gmail address.
Yeah.
That's the thing. So I decided that I would use Google to host my email, and they were offering a good deal at the time, free. And they still haven't started charging me. So if they did, I'd have to think about what I was going to do. But for now, again, I'm technically a paying customer. So hopefully it's not I hopefully would have, if they decided to terminate the relationship, as I said, I'd hopefully have enough time to get my data out and move it so nobody would notice.
I don't think I would. It kept me up a couple nights ago thinking about this.
Yeah. So would you consider getting a domain and slowly moving your email over time to an email address that's under your control, but may or may not be hosted by Google, so that if there's a problem, you could move it.
And yeah.
You know me, I'm a big believer in self-hosting, and it's a little different than the self-hosting community. I don't mind if I have another company that I pay to do something, as long as if I decide to take my business away from them, I don't have to do quite as much. So with mail, if you own the domain, in theory, you can't real easily lose the domain. There are ways to lose a domain, but you know, who's going to file a trademark issue against me or something like that to get it ripped away? So as long as I continue to pay the domain bill, I have the domain, and I can switch hosting without third parties having to deal with anything. I have to do some, you know, clerical work to do it.
Well, interestingly enough, when I thought about so what if I switch it to, if I create an email address and I just have everything forwarded to Google for now, if anything goes wrong with Google, then I could just, you know, set that email address up to point somewhere else, right? Change the MX records, whatever.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing I like. It's, as I said, it's different than rabid self-hosting, where it's, I want control of every stage of the process. I just want control of the end product.
But the domain name that I wanted to use is registered at Google using Google domains.
Yeah, but you can move a domain. I don't think Google can cut you off from the registrar side of things so easily.
I don't know, man, because I have to log into it with the account that is my email address. So if that account gets suspended for whatever reason, I can't log into I would be totally and completely hosed.
So that's sort of the question. Is there anything that you want to move?
Oh, yeah.
Because I just started moving some of my domains away from my registrar to a new registrar. And I have to wait until they have a sale to do more, because I did like 20 in one night.
Who are you moving to?
Well, I decided to go to Namecheap because I've used them for other things. They are the ones who do the domain hosting for my home assistant projects, because all of them do technically have a subdomain. So I can access them. Namecheap does dynamic
DNS. I'm a big fan of Hover. But Hover doesn't provide DNS services, whereas Google does. When you pay for it, then you automatically get domain services.
Yeah, the thing is, I found
DNS services.
Yeah, I found Namecheap worked nicely for me, and they do dynamic DNS among other things. As for Hover, I've never used it, but please do give Hover money, because I own 2Cows stock, and I believe that Hover is owned by 2Cows.
I love that they're not cheap. You know, they charge retail prices, but they don't, you know, one of the issues I had with GoDaddy was every time you tried to do anything, they're trying to, you know, upsell you 47 different things. Hover doesn't do that. Hover just says,
well,
the price.
Well, I had to leave the provider that I was with. I have to leave because I'm still partially there. A few years ago, a friend of someone arranged to set me up with a reseller account. I thought it might be an interesting idea to be a domain reseller, but I never did anything with it. And the person who set it up got out of that and wants me out of his account. So I have a sub account of his account. So I need a primary. And since I decided that I wasn't going to go into the domain reselling business, I'm just moving to somewhere where I can save some money. And Namecheap has never given me a problem with anything I've hosted there. And
cool.
So I can recommend them as somebody who's, again, not problematic and, you know, has sales regularly. In fact, I believe they're having a sale coming up. So should I give them a free plug for their upcoming sale? If anybody wants a domain, they are... in honor of their 21st birthday as a company, they're offering 21% off renewals and transfer domains or new.com for 21% off. Their sale starts on October 12th.
Cool. You said that they provide DNS services as part of hosting the domain. Not hosting the domain, but registering the domain.
Yeah. So I have the DNS hosted there, and I go in and they support dynamic DNS, so For example, I have a subdomain that's updated by my router.
They also cool. I will check them out.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as soon as I do that, they're going to be bought by Google.
I don't think so. By the way, if you are unhappy with Gmail, Daryl mentioned that he is moving his emails from Gmail to ProtonMail. And I've heard a lot about ProtonMail. But
you know who I really like? Zoho Mail.
Yeah, I know people who use them.
The only problem with Zoho Mail is I tend to have more than one email address. And you can't have more than one Zoho account open at once.
Yeah, and you could do something with the browser where you could have like isolated browser tabs, which is a thing.
I do that for a game I play where I want multiple accounts on the game.
Yeah, there.
Firefox calls them containers.
Yeah, so you could do something like that.
Kind of a pain in the butt, though.
I understand. But again, sometimes you have to compromise.
Yeah.
A few other things, since we have a few more interesting stories. YouTube has improved moving from watching on mobile to watching on desktop seamlessly.
Really?
They say they have.
I have not seen.
Do you move from your phone to your desktop and back with YouTube?
Yes.
Because I never watch YouTube on my desktop. I usually go to the Roku for that. Or similar device. So,
well, I sit here at my desk all day, so.
Yeah, but I sit at my desk, but my television isn't that far away. So, as you may recall, I have a one-bedroom, so what ends up happening is that my living room is next to my office. When I say next to, it's so that I could essentially touch what I will call my living room, since it's all part of a one larger room. Just divided. So I can see my television from my desk. I move it into position for that purpose.
Interesting.
Anyway, yeah. So you were talking about it earlier, but Home Assistant 2021.10 was released.
It was, and it has all sorts of cool stuff in it. Although this is my first release, and it was not a pain in the ass. It was not a pain at all.
Well, I have not. It hasn't been a pain for me yet because I haven't done the upgrade. I often save that for when I have some time, and I plan on having time over the weekend because it's a 3-day weekend here in the United States. By the way,
I did notice that the breaking changes list is like kind of long. Is it always about that long?
No, but you have to understand usually the change log is pretty long. The breaking changes list is pretty short most of the time. So this particular release, let's see, what do we have in breaking changes? I'm pulling it up on the screen. So let's see, breaking changes, they did something with templates. I think material design is one that ended up being a big breaking change because they updated all the icons.
Right.
So it's possible if you were using a specific icon that it might break, but that's because that's an upstream problem because they upgraded the entire icon set. Which happens.
Yeah, but breaking an icon that's not going to break, that's not going to stop your lights from turning on.
Yeah, they also, templates now have stricter returns for certain functions. If you're using the Echo ecosystem, they remove the support for legacy fan speeds, which they've been doing in all providers, because they changed the fan speeds a few versions ago. In the Discovery API, they essentially are removing it. So this is the endpoint discovery info because they're planning on removing that at the end of the year for whatever reason. So they migrated the DLNA digital media rendering integration to configuration via the UI instead of YAML. And they do that for a lot of integrations because they're moving everything out of YAML into the new storage file, which I believe it's not new anymore. It's actually been there for a while, but they've been doing that thing by thing, that you can no longer do certain configurations in YAML, you have to do them in the interface. So that includes things like modem caller ID. So this is a breaking change because your YAML configuration will be imported on upgrade into the release and then will be removed afterwards. So this is technically a breaking change, but it doesn't actually break anything.
This was one of those things that I called and asked you about. I was like, dude, I've got a lot of stuff set up, but my configuration file is empty.
Yeah.
What the heck?
But over time, fewer things are going in there. Now, my guess is at the end, it'll be that the YAML files will be for things like complex automations, but you won't see any of the configuration stuff in there. They'll all be configured in the UI and stored in storage.
Well, I now have stuff in my config file, which is how I noticed that it was empty.
Yeah, and I have stuff in there, mostly custom stuff, but eventually some of that stuff will end up in the UI. That's what always happens. And it's gotten very interesting. Because again, I don't always want to go and do a YAML file and reboot the server in order to get something new. So I'm fine with that. As long as I can tweak the same things, I'm fine with where I actually do it. In other exciting news, if you are interested in smart home development, the Smart Home Developer Summit is being hosted by Google on October 21st. And you can register online.
Ooh.
I'm sure you're going, Jerry.
You know, I don't know.
Even just to watch. Well, this is sort of the thing. Yeah. It's different when it's like an in-person event and you have to go to the other side of the country. I don't know about you, but you know, even on a topic where, okay, I wouldn't pay to go to Google I/O, even though I'm sure there's a lot of interesting things, I would save that for, you know, professional developers. But if I'm interested, why not tune into like a session if it's being done remotely? I don't feel the inconvenience. Even if the session's recorded and I watch it later, why not if it's interesting?
Yep.
Now, according to Google, the most popular search term on Bing is Google. That is one of their defenses in their current litigation. They are saying that it is not that they are abusing their market dominance, that they are a product that everybody knows about. And even on their competitors, people are looking for them. And again, I'm not sure I fully agree with that, that they do not use their market dominance to continue to dominate. But again, that is what businesses do. So, but are they also at the same time right that they have put out a product that's extremely compelling and that is why people use it?
Well, yeah, they have.
Yeah, but again, I think people are right to ask the question of whether or not companies are taking advantage of the fact they've become so large to prevent other companies from conducting business. However, you know, whether the remedy for that should be aggressive government action, I would say I don't necessarily think so.
Well, we know what I think.
Yes, I know. But notice I didn't say no government action. I said aggressive government action. Two different things. So that's
are they though?
Differ. No, that's where we differ. You think that the government shouldn't go anywhere, whereas I think the government often goes too far. Or in some cases, they don't go far enough, but different things.
You know, I was driving my daughter to school today. And this was, no, not today, yesterday. And she had an incredible insight. And she's 15 years old. She said, Dad, it seems like it's
good. John has logged in.
Oh, come on. You're killing me, folks.
Say hi to the guy logged in.
It seems to me, says my daughter, that governments tend to grow, that a large portion of their, you know, it's just, you know, people do what they're motivated to do, and people in government are motivated to grow government. So governments don't shrink. So does that mean we're basically screwed, that government is always just going to keep growing?
Corporations don't shrink that much either. Not the big ones. They just keep growing also.
Oh, companies go out of business all the time.
Yeah.
Even big ones.
I know, but what I'm saying is that companies, they either go out of business or they just keep growing. Companies don't decide to shrink. In your example, the government would have to decide to stop doing certain things.
Or they get overthrown.
I'd rather not have a revolution.
It makes me, well, I mean.
No, I'm saying that.
If you think long term, right?
there are plenty of things
government
I don't like about the
US, actually lasts forever.
Yeah, but all I'm going to say in regards to that is me not being happy with some of the things that are going on in the United States does not mean that I want the United States government to collapse.
No, I'm with you, bro.
I'm hoping that I do not live for the day when the United States has collapsed. That would be depressing. I do not want.
Have you heard the term national divorce?
Is that where the country splits into little countries?
It's basically where land gets split up into, you know, if you're a Democrat, go here. If you're a Republican, go there. And we're going to create two different nations. Y'all can be you and we'll be us.
I don't know. There's sometimes when Florida seems like a different country.
Says the guy living in New York.
Yes, I've been to Florida. It seems like it's a very different place than New York.
Everywhere is a different place than New York.
That would
there is no place else that is like New York.
Well, you could say that about Florida also. Can you name another place? Every place is unique.
No, I mean, like, and I would say that Florida and Texas are very similar.
Oh, I think Texas should be split up. It's too big.
Anyway,
California
just a thought.
And Texas are too big. Divide them up. Anyway. But again, Daryl has commented on a few things just to catch up with him. He, like you, agrees that nobody wants the government to collapse necessarily, but most people want it to be smaller and less intrusive. And again, I will agree that it depends on the area. There are places where I feel like the government belongs, and there are places I feel like it doesn't. And again, some of them I may be aligned with both of you, and some of them I may not be.
Well, I would say that it was your governor that said a thing that
the upset current one me. Or the one who just left?
The current one.
Oh, Hochul?
And she said something, and the thing that really, really bugged me about what she said was not that she said it, but that there was no outrage about her saying it.
Which thing?
She said government's primary job is to keep you safe.
It actually is one of the three jobs of local government.
I don't believe that. You know how you keep people safe? You lock them in their house and you turn the electricity off.
That would be an excessive.
Take away, make belts illegal so people can't hang themselves. I mean, safe is, no, it's not.
Safe is relative.
It is no part of the government's job to keep you safe.
Then what's the army?
Now, we can say, well, that's defense of the nation. That's not you as an individual.
Again, was she saying that individuals to be kept safe or the community to be kept safe?
She said you.
Yes, but you in the English language could be singular or plural. It's very imprecise. In other languages, you have two different words. So the question is, was she saying you in the singular, as in the government's job is to keep every individual safe, or that the government's job is to keep the community in general safe?
The context was keep the individuals safe.
To the extent possible. And again,
she didn't say that. She did not say it with any limitations whatsoever.
No, what I'm saying is that the government's job is to try to keep people safe in a broad sense, not in an individual sense. Again, that's the purpose for the army. That's the purpose for police. That's the purpose for EMTs, services that the government has taken on. I'm not sure if you'd want some of those things to be handled by private enterprise, at least not policing. But again, there are other areas where the government shouldn't be involved. And again, I take it on an area-by-area question. So in some of them, I am aligned with you, and in some of them, I'm not, which you know from our conversations. Also, if you watch the government, the people who are making these decisions are not informed about the thing that they are actually making decisions about, which by that definition, I am in 100% agreement with you that these people should not be making decisions for other people.
Well, I was just impressed that she made a very, you know, she made a really good observation that, anyway.
Well, she has a good reputation and she had nothing to do with her predecessor, despite being the lieutenant governor. So, that's a plus against her. Admittedly, there were useful things about Cuomo, but he was not really a human being that I wanted to hear from most of the time. Anyway, that's a whole other can of
worms. You know, we've been here for over an hour today.
It's been a while since we've had a long show. I enjoy it every so often. But the thing is, in terms of government being prepared to solve problems, there are capable people in government, but there are also a lot of incapable people who do not know what they're doing. Look at what was that thing that happened this week with somebody asking the person being called upon from Facebook if Facebook was going to stop Finsta. I think it was Senator Blumenthal, was it? But the thing is, that would demonstrate that a senator was willing to go on camera and ask questions without actually understanding anything he was talking about in a congressional hearing. And these are the people who are making policy, or hopefully they have staff who know what they're talking about, who are advising them on what policy they're making. But disappointing. Anyway, moving along, USB-C cables will be showing how fast they can charge with new power ratings, which could be more confusing. However, I would like it if my cable told me whether or not it would work for the purpose that I have bought it for. So I am in favor of the cable telling me what it is rated to do. At least in theory.
And does this mean that it has to show a rating? So it has to be tested by some...
Well, no.
In order by who's going to do the testing? How much are they going to charge for it? Is it going to be illegal to sell it to cable that hasn't been tested?
Well, again, if it has...
Is this going to increase the cost of cables?
Well, I would assume that if it doesn't have this rating, then it hasn't been tested, which means you're on your own, along with the same way that you are now, with some of those USB-C cables you would get online that would burn out your devices. This comes in a lot of things. A company may pay for certification, but as a consumer, you may want to pay for certification because that means that you feel more comfortable with the product. If that isn't a value to you, you can go with the product that doesn't have certification on it, but may cause your phone to explode. It might not, by the way. That's why, you know, look at electrical, look at Underwriters Laboratory. Look at organizations.
UL certification is required.
But what I'm saying is that's you paying an organization to certify things.
It's the same. And not by choice. It's the government trying to keep me safe.
I could think of other examples that are not the government mandated, but I'm saying it's the same idea. You are paying for a symbol, and that symbol gives people comfort. So that is a marketing tool. Regardless of whether or not the government mandates it or not, a company certifying something means that you know it is to a certain standard. Because if that company rubber stamped things, then they would not have the trust. So their currency as a company is trust. That is their brand is what's most important, and they'll act to protect it. By the way, you could consider certification to be self-regulation.
Yep.
So that, I would think that you would prefer self-regulation to government regulation.
I don't know. I think self-regulation is better than governmental regulation.
Yeah, and again, this is self-regulation that is managed by essentially the market. So the certification...
So this is not a government...
No.
Specifying this.
No.
This like is the USB. The European Union saying everybody's got to use USB-C to charge.
No, this is the standards organization for USB cables, saying that if you want to say that you meet the standard, it has to meet the standard, and we're not going to let you put our symbol on it saying that it meets the standard unless it actually does. So the trust is with the organization that certifies it, and their motive is if they put their stamp on something that is not up to standard, then again, nobody will trust them. So they will enforce it. And again, you know, if you look at Daryl, for example, he bought cables guaranteed to handle 100 watt charging rates, and those are not cheap. But again, if you use a cheap cable, then it will either not work or it will burn out. And it could cause problems for the devices it's connected to. So I do buy cheap cables, but when I buy cheap cables, they are good cheap cables. They are ones that have a good reputation. I don't just buy the cheapest thing I can find. So there's budget versus cheap in that regard. So I'm in favor of certification, and I grew up on it. You've heard me talk about religious things. I'm not sure. Have I ever talked to you about kosher certification?
No.
So kosher food, be it a kosher restaurant or food that's deemed kosher, it is deemed kosher not because it is, as there are some people who think, blessed by a rabbi, but because it is certified by a kosher certification. So what does that mean? It means that somebody from that organization went there and checked that everything was being done in accordance with the various religious rules associated with that. So if I do not see certain symbols on food, then I know that I can't trust that food. And you've probably seen them dozens of times without paying attention, because it's not something you would particularly be concerned about.
Yep. I see USDA certifications.
So when you get a chance, go to food. And the most common kosher symbol would be... A U in a circle is the symbol of the Orthodox Union, which is one of the biggest certifying organizations for kosher food. And you would see that on a variety of products. And again, that organization, if a company that was making food did not have that, then they could be doing things exactly the same way, but how would you trust them? So that symbol means trust, and the organization protects their brand. For example, I did hear a story once of an organization that had several product lines. One of them was kosher and one wasn't. And they accidentally put the symbol on the non-kosher product line. And the Orthodox Union made them pull the entire product line and reprint the bags. But again, it's back to... that's trust. So that's certified by an organization, and you can trust that that organization is not going to let their name be run through the mud. And I can tell you some controversial stories about cutthroat kosher food fights. But that's, again, a whole other story. But it's the same thing as USB cables. It's the trust of the organization, and those organizations will protect that trust. Because otherwise, their symbol is worth nothing, and they're out of business. But again, they can't command the money that they get for certifying things. And certification isn't free, no matter if it's food certification in this example or it's USB-C certification. You do pay these organizations part of the cost of doing business so that people trust that your product will work the way that you say it will and will not cause your house to catch fire or cause your device to explode. Anyway, moving along, Google's DNS service was apparently slowed amidst some sort of massive Facebook outage. By the way, there was a Facebook outage. I'm not sure if you noticed.
I was told about it. I didn't actually notice.
WhatsApp.
WhatsApp, yes.
WhatsApp is part of the Facebook group. Apparently, from all reports, they misconfigured their routing for their various servers and essentially made it so that nobody on the internet could find them. But
which was mildly amusing.
Yeah, and apparently that slowed down the Google DNS service, and it rekindled a push for a free and open web, the idea that so much of the internet should not be tied up in one company. Remember, in some, especially developing countries where the internet is subsidized by companies like Facebook. Facebook is the internet.
I didn't even know that was a thing, but okay, cool.
Well, look at India. Look at some of the, again, look at some countries where the entire internet for them is Facebook or services like that. Look at people who, their internet for them is Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, all these services that are, again, run by one company. And regardless of what you may think, you know, of this whole, you know, let's break up the monopoly sort of thing, having one company having so much control is something where, again, we let it happen as a society, but it's, again, concerning, which is why I do believe that there should be things that are not Facebook out there. And I would like to encourage some of them.
I can agree with that.
Yeah.
Not because I think being successful should be punished. Not because of that.
So, well, again, I'm not in favor of punishment either. Admittedly, I would like it if somebody called Facebook out on a bunch of things, but we'll see. The other question being, if you were a WhatsApp user or a Facebook Messenger user, did you try another messaging app? Because apparently Telegram got like 5 million signups.
That's funny.
Yeah. Do you use Telegram, Jerry?
I do not.
Signal?
We actually reverted to SMS.
I have that too.
I only use WhatsApp for family. So I have their phone numbers, so I just send them text messages.
I'm equal opportunity. I will just have an account on every service and just link them together so that I don't know what service people are coming into me on. So that's my free and open thing. I don't have, you know, wherever somebody is, I'll talk to them there as long as I don't have to figure out, once I've set up the integration, I don't have to figure it out. That's why I use things like Pigeon. So Pigeon has everything and it just pops up whatever service I'm connected to and I just don't have to care. If you are a user of Gmail, the contacts are coming to the Gmail sidebar. Nice little feature. Not earth-shattering, but I find it helpful.
Sure. Another thing that needs to be loaded when you load up Gmail.
That's the problem, that they're putting all these things in. But as I said, I can sort of see the motivation for having your contact list inside your email. I'm not so sure you need your chat inside the email. Or Meet. But I see contacts.
That's I completely 100% agree. Yeah. Yep.
So let's see what else we have here. Oh, yes. The new YubiKey key allows you to me YubiKo key. Why did I say YubiKey key? YubiKo key allows you to use your fingerprint. So it has a built-in fingerprint scanner.
That's neat.
Yeah. I have a YubiKo around here somewhere, but being lazy, I don't use it enough. I've been doing a lot of two-factor, but I hate pulling out a device and trying to push it into my computer every time I want to do something. So I should, but I haven't. Speaking of
cool.
Yeah, speaking of two-factor, Google is going to auto-enroll 150 million users in their two-step auth. That's not two-factor. It's called two-step because that's the one where your phone displays a message as opposed to it being something independent. So that's sort of the push notification type two-factor. My employer started doing that. So now I have to have an app on my phone for my employer that pushes messages to my phone asking if I've logged into my work computer. So I asked them, well, what if I didn't have a personal phone? How was I supposed to get into this thing? They didn't really have a good answer for that. Fortunately, I do have a personal phone, but...
Huh. I haven't been to YubiKo in a while. They've got a wide variety.
Yeah, they've really expanded. They, you know, they added USB-C, they added NFC, they added a lot of different versions. And despite the fact I admit that I am not lazy enough to properly use YubiKo security, I do recognize that they are good at that. And finally, if you want to send Jerry or I a gift, you can now do so without knowing our address. So as long as you know somebody's email address or their phone number, you can send them a gift through Amazon now. So what Amazon will do, and I think this is a brilliant move on Amazon's part, if you know enough about them to have them in your address book, you can send them a gift, and the person who you're sending a gift will get a notification probably, I'm assuming through email, that they can either do one of several things. They can accept the gift, in which case Amazon will ship it using the gift receiver's choice of address. They can reject the gift and tell the person they don't want a gift. Or they can accept the gift but not actually receive it and have it converted into an Amazon gift card. So essentially they can return the gift automatically.
Wow. Cool.
It seems
so. Amazon continue, as big as Amazon is, they continue to innovate.
Yeah, it just seems sort of cold. It's, you can automatically accept somebody's gift and convert it into cash. As long as, you know, on the other hand, as long as I don't know you converted into cash, I'm not offended that you didn't like my gift.
Yep.
I don't know. I find gift giving hard to begin with. Finding the right thing for people. I have this philosophy. Even if there's no reason to give somebody a gift, if I'm thinking that they might deserve a gift sometime during the year, if there's no occasion, but I find the perfect thing for them, I'll just get it at that point and tell them this is for the future thing that I would have had trouble getting you. So I just strike when the iron is hot, so to speak.
Cool.
Yeah, a few other things, just to wrap up with some Daryl commentary. First of all, Daryl's comment is that he is not Jewish, but if it's kosher, he knows that it's now gross. That's not necessarily true. Again, like everything, there are plenty of gross products that are both kosher and not kosher. For example, Jerry, do you like Oreos? I don't particularly.
Yes.
People like Oreos.
Who doesn't like Oreos?
Yes, but Oreos are kosher. They've been kosher since the 90s. Before that, Hydrox was the only sandwich cookie brand that was kosher. That was when I was growing up. But the thing is that a lot of products are certified kosher. Now, that may mean that there are certain ingredients that are removed and replaced. But most of the time, there's no real difference except for the fact that somebody's standing at the factory making.
I don't even know. What are the kosher rules?
I can give you a few examples that are. The biggest, okay. Most obvious one would be no mixing of meat and dairy. So you can't have milk in a product that contains. You'd be surprised.
So no hot dog milkshakes.
Well, I'll give you a different one. Did you know that many hot dog buns that are sold at the supermarket actually have dairy in them?
Yeah, it's bread.
Bread doesn't have to have dairy in it. I'm not saying it can't, but kosher bread usually does not have dairy products in it.
So, does that mean you can't have cake?
Of course you can have cake.
Cake has milk in it, right?
Yeah.
Milk that and
bread,
eggs?
That bread would be dairy. But I'm saying, you know, kosher, general kosher bread, so that it appeals to the broadest kosher audience, would not have dairy in it, because then it can be used with either a meat or a dairy meal. Since the two can't be mixed. There's also, of course, the obvious one that most people know, which is no pork.
Wait, does that mean that, like, okay, you're sitting down for breakfast. If you want to have a glass of milk, you can't have bacon.
I can't have bacon. No pig products.
It's so sad. You live a baconless existence?
I don't know what I'm missing. By the way, I can't have beef bacon, which is a thing, by the way.
Do you know what ambrosia is?
I've heard of it, yes.
But you're the concept that it was the food of the gods.
Yes,
right?
I know what you're talking about.
I am convinced that ambrosia was just another word for bacon.
Again, I could always go with beef bacon.
Bacon is like...
How about bacon?
No. Thinly sliced, or not so thinly sliced pieces. It's just, it's
okay.
Oh, it's so good.
Well, you know what they say? It's not because it tastes bad that I don't have it. So I'll just say that I've heard good things. One other thing from Daryl. Daryl is going to have some medical work done tomorrow. So I'm going to say that we all wish him well.
Good luck, man.
Because he continues to be our favorite Daryl. But he did enjoy this podcast.
And this long podcast.
No, he said this podcast overall. It's been his favorite podcast for 10 years.
Oh.
So hopefully he will be back in the future to listen to us. So hopefully every... So I wish him well in his recovery from whatever he's
prayers doing. And wishes and rainbows, man. Prayers and wishes and rainbows.
Yeah. And that's it for tonight for us. And next week, hopefully, I will come back and report that I flashed some more electrical devices and done some more home automation work. Because I'm home, which makes me thrilled to do homework. I've missed it.
And hopefully I will have some actual automations done.
I love automations. Right now I'm doing integrations because I have to fix some broken stuff. But they're keyed into existing automations because it's just replacing hardware. But I have some other things coming down the pike in terms of ventilation and such. So, because I still have to replace that controller in my fan with the one that has the US capacitors. I think I told you that story too.
I believe you did.
Yeah. So lots of little things to do that will make my apartment a better place to live in. And I'm living here, which makes me really happy. Anyway, until next week, and Daryl, we'll be thinking of you.
Yes, we will. So, good night, everybody. Thanks for sticking out, you know, sticking this podcast out to the end. And if you didn't get here, then you're not hearing this, so I don't care. Arr.
Goodbye, Jerry.
Goodbye.